listening to WORT Madison. I am your host, Allison Jacoby, and this is the Perpetual Notion Machine. In the last few weeks, we heard from some UW researchers on some current phenomena within the atmosphere and on our planet. Today, however, we are diverting our focus to the methods of communicating these difficult topics. Today, we are joined virtually by Callie Moore from University of Montana. She's a paleontologist and collections manager at the university, but also a co-host of the PBS YouTube show Eons. So in a few moments, we will not only take a look into the complexities of communicating science effectively, but look further into what you, the listener, can do to better understand and engage with these topics and discussions. So Callie, could you start by telling us about how you first became interested in paleontology and your journey into becoming essentially a fossil librarian?
Yeah, I was a dino kid. I loved dinosaurs. I loved fossils when I was a kid. And so it was just kind of, I never got out of it. So I just kind of went forward with my love of paleontology. And although I did like dinosaurs, I didn't live anywhere near dinosaurs growing up. So I was in Kansas City. So there's not a lot of dinosaurs there. So most of the fossils that I was collecting were about 320, 350 million year old invertebrates. So animals without backbones and little shells and snails and things like that, and crinoids. And I loved it. That's where I cut my teeth, I guess. I have worked on dinosaur digs since then, but that's where I got started. And I stayed with it all through college and got a earth science degree with a minor in paleontology, and applied for my job up at the University of Montana and shockingly got it. I kind of just put it out there in the universe and it came back to me, which was really great. And all throughout this time, especially in my undergraduate and in my normal job at the University of Montana, I do a lot of science communicating. So giving tours to kids or the public or doing fossil show and tells, fossil identifications and that. And so I've been science communicating for a while before I started with Eons, which is like the ultimate science communicating.
Are there any areas in the paleontology department that you specifically specialize in, or do you kind of have a well-versed overall knowledge of the history and what you do and how that affects the public?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of the jack of all trades when it comes to paleontology. I know a little bit about the entire history of life on Earth, and I really enjoy that. If I were to specialize, I have been recently kind of working on late Eocene, early Oligocene plant sites, actually, which is a big 180 from anywhere that I've ever worked or anything I've ever worked on. And these are plants and animals that would have lived about 30 to 40 million years ago. And like I said, they just have kind of fallen in my lap, and I find them very fascinating, especially with the little fossil insects and sometimes soft body preserved amphibians. So we have like external gills and body outlines and eyeballs and things like that preserved. It's really amazing. But that's probably, if I had to focus on something, it would be kind of in that 30 to 40 million year old range, and happens to be insects and amphibians and plants.
Do you have other students in your department that you're able to share that knowledge with? And are they able to do any research on that or make new findings?
Yeah, so I have a pretty robust volunteer program. I don't teach at the University of Montana. I'm just a staff member. So my main job is to care for the collection and make it accessible to researchers and anybody that would want to do research on the collection or even see the collection. So my volunteers work very intimately with the collection. They're assigned a case, and it's their job to go through an inventory, all the specimens that are in that case. And sometimes they get a case that is full of like little tiny rodent teeth, and they're not very excited about it. And then other times they're working on big giant ancient camels or something like that, and they tend to like the bigger stuff more. But I think that's kind of the public in general likes the big flashy stuff. So, but they get a lot of hands-on experience, not only with the fossils, how to handle the fossils, but also with data entry and how museums work. Usually have these big databasing programs that we use to input all of this information. They learn how important it is to not only label your fossils, but also legibly legibly label fossils and how important that is. So I hope some of the skills that they get when they work with me translates to their higher academia learning and experience as well, and be like the person that always labeled their stuff very nicely and everybody loves them because of it.
Yeah, that definitely seems important. With those skills that you're hoping you're instilling on them, have you found that you need to communicate differently depending on the demographic, whether it's students or, say, colleagues versus the public? But how do you think your skills have translated between the different groups that you're communicating to?
For sure, for sure. There's totally different levels that I communicate with. I have my K through third grade level of communication. It was big and this was small, you know, like you're kind of on a different level. And then by about fourth and fifth to sixth grade, kids are really learning stuff and they've had some science, and sometimes they are going through their own dinosaur phase, and so they know more dinosaur names than I do. So I can kind of kick it up a notch there. But for my volunteers, they come from all over campus. It's not just geo kids, but I have wildlife biology majors, I have ecology majors, I have history majors, business majors. And so there is a vast difference on what they know about the history of life on our planet, or just even time itself, being able to understand deep time. So when I'm talking to my business kids, I have to back up quite a ways. I usually start with a question. Are you familiar with the Ordovician? And if they just look at me with a blank stare, I'm like,
yeah.
And then if I say that to somebody that's in the geological sciences, I'll be like, do you know the Ordovician? They'll be like, yeah, sort of. But if I'm talking to colleagues, other paleontologists, technically that isn't science communication, but we take it to a whole nother nerd level. We are up in the stratosphere. Like, we don't have to back up to know what each other knows. It's some of the most enjoyable conversations I ever get to have, because I don't have to back up. I don't have to describe and define. We can really cover a lot of ground. Just recently, when I was at the University of Wisconsin, I did get to go into the paleo collection and meet with one of the paleontologists. And we just had so much fun. And even the collections manager of the paleontology collection was, oh, I never get to talk like high level paleo with anybody. This is so nice. It's refreshing. So definitely a range. You really need to understand where your audience is before you just kind of like jump in at them, for sure.
Knowing all of this, I'm assuming you got the job at the university before Eons, is that correct?
Yeah. I was at the university for about 8 years or so before Eons started.
Was it a difficult transition to adjust the way you communicated in that academic environment to the Eons show? And when you started with the Eons show, what was the demographic you guys were trying to reach? And were there some conflicts between how other people like to communicate versus what your natural approach to communicating was?
Yeah, transitioning, or at least adding on Eons to my normal science communicating in person, it wasn't too bad. But when I'm on Eons, I'm talking to a camera. I don't have people's faces of understanding or anybody nodding or looking at me weird or knowing that people are falling asleep when I'm talking or something like that. So I can't really change up my style of delivery based on the feedback that I get from my audience. And so it's much more kind of a sterile environment. It's a little tiny room with a bunch of very bright lights in front of like a green sheet, you know, and I'm looking into the darkness of a teleprompter. It's not personal, but I do have people in the room helping me, being like, oh no, you read that like it was being read. I'm like, well, I'm reading it, but it sounds like I'm reading it and not just being able to spout all this information off. So I do get direction in the studio. When we first launched Eons, because we were going to talk about dinosaurs and fossils, we thought our audience was going to skew much younger. And it became readily apparent by like our fourth episode that this was not the case. And we had an audience that was very hungry for high level science. They wanted like high school to college level interpretations of this. And so we brought it up based on the feedback that we got in the comment section on our YouTube videos, which happened very quickly. And so since then, it seems like we've hit a very comfortable level where everybody's pretty comfortable. And we also do a really good job, I think, of not using jargon to just sound smart. And if we do need to use some jargony word, we always try to define it right there in the sentence with the word. So everybody's on the same level when we use terminology like that. So I think we've hit a really good balance between high level science and being able to effectively communicate that science.
Across doing your YouTube show with Eons, even as the collections manager, have you found any methods that has helped you the most? Or do you think there are certain methods that maybe the listener to this could utilize if they're talking about a difficult topic that their audience may not be as receptive to or may not be able to understand right away?
There's a couple of things that I have found. Being enthusiastic about what you're talking about, it's contagious. Your audience will also start to get really super excited about whatever you're talking about. So I give a lecture about some 324 million year old fish fossils. And people are usually like, fish? Really? That's what you're going to go with? But I've had so many people come up to me afterwards and be like, your enthusiasm for these fish makes me want to know more about these fish and study these fish, you know, like they get how excited I am to talk about these things. I always like to have audience participation. So sometimes I'll start off my lectures before I even get into the table of contents. I'll ask a question to know where people are at. So when I gave my lecture at the University of Wisconsin, I asked right before, who knows about Eons and just know about it? Who's watched one Eons episode? Who's watched five Eons episode? Who's watched it all the way to the blooper reel at the end, you know, to kind of get a feel for where my audience is at, but also to get them engaged right off the bat. I normally like to walk around the stage. I'm arm wavy when I talk. I tell jokes. I use memes. I try to be very humorous and casual, even if I'm talking about the end Permian extinction event, the greatest mass extinction of our planet's history. You know, I still try to bring in a little bit of lightheartedness and make people feel comfortable and make myself seem approachable. So I'm not just like the clear-eyed guy in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, you know, this monotoned voice. I've been in lectures like that, and I don't want my audience to sit through that. So I try to be the exact opposite of that guy.
So one thing you mentioned in your seminar was talking about difficult topics, talking about when there was maybe someone in history, a paleontologist, that was not so truthful. So when you're going about topics like that, do you still rely on maybe that enthusiasm, humor to get around a subject like that? Or have you found that there's other paths you need to take when communicating that as to avoid doom culture when you're talking about topics like climate change or politics?
It's a tough call. Every single problematic scientist that we deal with, we go at it on a case-by-case basis. Right now, we don't have just like a flat policy, you know. If they were a racist bigot in the past, we just don't even mention them. So a lot of people in these Victorian era times had really horrific ideas, especially about human evolution. But at the same time, some of the best examples of our family tree were being found. You had two different lines of thought, and some of these guys with really horrible ideas about human evolution were the same people that found these really important fossils. So it's hard to separate the scientists from the science or even the specimens. So a lot of times we take it like on a case-by-case basis. If they are not pivotal to the story, it's just like an offhanded comment, it was collected by some guy at this time, we won't mention their name. We'll just kind of ignore them and just be like, a German scientist did this or something, you know. If they are pivotal to the story and we are talking about something that they had a horrible idea about, then we will just call them out. And we try to be serious on those moments. Serious needs some serious. I use my mom voice, you know, like I'm not a mom, but I have one and I know the I'm in trouble voice. And so we try to be serious when things need you to be serious about. But like one of them, we did a TikTok about Robert Broom, and he had some really bad ideas, but he also found some really cool stuff. And we were kind of making fun of him because he hunted for fossils in the nude. Who does that? Yeah. You know, like, we thought full body sunlight was good for the mind.
Interesting.
We were making fun of this man, but we also had to add in a sentence about, like, okay, yeah, this is a pretty lighthearted, pokey, fun TikTok that we're doing, but this man had some really awful ideas, and those ideas have made their way all the way through the ages. You know, like, we definitely want people to know, don't put a picture up of Robert Broom in your office type of thing. But haha, serves you right. You forgot your clothes in the desert.
Have you noticed science communicators that have maybe gone about it in the wrong direction have negatively impacted society as it is today? And do you see any major problematic indicators of that?
What comes to mind is when people throw praise at somebody, but they didn't realize somebody was a horrible person or had horrible theories about whatever. They just didn't know. And then they make a video or, you know, some type of social media post saying, like, hey, look at all this cool stuff that this person did. And then, you know, the comment section is full of, well, you know, he was an anti-Semite, right? So that's probably what I see the most of, is just people not researching their topic or their person in the greatest of detail and just skimming the surface and then being called out, like, hey, you're giving this person that, like, a lot of praise that they might not should get that praise. The other thing is just misinformation, but misinformation is not science communication. So, like, people are trying to muddy the waters and make people understand science even less and then also mistrust science. And so I think that that's definitely when it gets dangerous, is that when you're twisting words, you're twisting hypotheses for a more nefarious reason. That's really bad. But again, that's not science communicating. You're sending the wrong message, basically, with that. And so, but yeah, just not checking your people out in thorough detail.
I do remember in your seminar talking about that. Have you made any mistakes like that in terms of maybe misinformation or getting the wrong message across? And what do you think the best course of action is to go about that?
Factually, we don't get a lot of things wrong. I was brought on to fact check shortly after the channel started, and I am proud to say I have not missed many things. Little tiny stuff here and there. But on the whole, I'm doing a really good job of fact checking. And so factually, most of our episodes are pretty good. We have a historical anthropologist on our team that knows all the dirty little secrets of all the Victorian scientists. And so she's definitely a sounding board anytime we do a human evolution episode. However, where we tend to run afoul is sometimes with our images. So one of our most watched episodes is about a megalodon, and we talk about a blue whale, like the largest species of animal that has ever evolved, the blue whale. And we show a blue-colored humpback whale. And so in those cases, when we screw up like that, we usually just pin a comment to the very, very top. Oh, my gosh, it's wrong. It's supposed to be a blue whale, not a humpback whale. We went back and looked at the stock photo site we were using, and it was labeled blue whale, but, like, nobody caught it. So I was also brought on shortly after to fact check for images in our full length episodes. But just in January, we got caught, even though that's, it makes it seem like we were trying to do this and not get caught, but it was a complete mistake. We used, like, an AI parrot, an AI generated art parrot. And, like, there's tons of images out there. It was just real brightly colored or whatever. It was vertical. It was tight in on the head. You know, what we're looking for a TikTok, for a short form video. That's all we needed. It was on the screen for probably less than a second. But it was AI generated. And I remember kind of seeing it and be like, oh, man, that parrot needs its bill trimmed. It's, like, really long. Well, my brain was telling me that there was something wrong, but my brain is not looking out for AI art yet. It's so new. It's so new. Well, memes were made. People were calling us out on various social platforms. And this all happened on a Saturday. And so we were just, like, horrified. Oh, my gosh, we were horrified. So we pulled that episode. We made a post on social medias that says, like, oh, my gosh, we made a mistake. Our stock image site is not labeling AI art yet. And we have a robust anti-AI art policy. Like we have a policy in place that was supposed to keep this from happening, but things slip through the crack. And this is still really new. I mean, the first AI generated artwork just came out like in 2022. So we took it down, changed that image to a real parrot, and re-uploaded it. But we came clean, and the response to that was 99% positive. People were really happy that we said something, we pulled the image, we rectified the situation, basically, instead of just being like, whatever. So I think definitely coming clean as soon as possible, as soon as it's brought to your attention. And then if you have the ability to pull whatever content that was and fix the problem and then put it back out there is probably the best course of action.
So you mentioned AI art, and it sounds like that started a lot of trouble for you guys. Is there any developments in AI that you've noticed that may be harmful to whether that's the general public, communicating science in general, even, say, politics or other topics? Are you worried at all about what AI might do to the way information is released and perceived?
Definitely. Just being a woman in this century, it's scary to think what could be done and how my image could be manipulated, especially since I am on YouTube. Like, there are videos of me saying basically every word in the English language. And so that is terrifying. For paleo right now, AI is too much of a generalist to pose that much of a threat to paleo artists, for example. So if you put a prompt like Tyrannosaurus Rex or Triceratops or Woolly Mammoth into most of these AI generators, you're going to get back something that looks like what you put in there. There's enough data for those generators to use to mash together something. But it also kind of depends on the generator that you're using. So some generators are better than others, and they have really crazy ideas of what, like, even a Triceratops, which is a really well-known, well-imaged dinosaur. And so it's really based on how much data is out there and how much of that data is accessible to each generator. But worrying about a generator making AI art about some unknown fossil that, like, only the nerds of the nerds know about, this group of fossils or this group of animals, there's not enough data out there for these generators to even come close. Or if you had a brand new species, new to science and everything, come out, again, there's just not enough information yet these AI generators can use to be able to create all, like, super fast AI art based on a paper that came out that day. There's just not enough yet. So for paleo art, AI art still has quite a long ways to go, but it's gonna happen eventually. I'm assuming they're gonna get better and better, and they're gonna learn more and more and more and have access to more and more data. So in paleontology, I think we have a little room to not have to worry so much about it, but I feel like definitely there will be a time that we'll have to worry about it. But right now, we work with a lot of human paleo artists. So we always commission artwork for almost every single episode. So at least we'll know that some of our artwork is definitely not AI generated. The other thing is, a couple of the people that responded to our post about the AI art was telling us to put in our search results on these stock images, images that were uploaded before 2022.
When AI started rolling, yeah.
Yep. And so you can kind of avoid anything that would have been created by AI art on the stock images site if you say before 2022. So that's probably something that we're going to be looking at doing until these big stock images sites start to actually label stuff as AI art.
And going along with that, with what the audience can do themselves, as consumers of the scientific information, topics like paleontology or just in general, how can the listeners promote accurate and effective science communication? Or what can science communicators do differently to promote that accurate information that's being released within their own networks and communities?
Yeah, I would say make sure you're only using information from peer-reviewed journals. You might get the PopSci article about that peer-reviewed journal article, and a lot of peer-reviewed science is paywalled, so I don't anticipate the general public to pay $35 for an access to a single piece of paper, basically. But, you know, read the Cliff Notes, which is the PopSci article, but make sure that it's coming out of the Society for Vertebrate Paleontology, the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology, Paleontology. There are a lot of big name journals that I would think would be your most reputable sources. Also, some news websites are a little better than others. The BBC usually does pretty good when talking about finds, even though they called this giant plesiosaur that was found off the coast of England like giant monster dinosaur swimmer or something like that. It's not a dinosaur, it's a swimming reptile, but yeah, they put a lot of words in there for, you know, clickbait. So some sites are better than others. If you can find the peer-reviewed journal article, maybe go through it to double-check the images. So even as I say, try to stay with peer-reviewed journal articles. They're also not immune to running into AI art problems. I think that the more AI art is used and the more backlash becomes of it, there's going to be programs that will come out that can spot it. You could run your image through a software and it would tell you if it was AI generated or not. I hope that that's something that happens someday. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the AI art people will write codes to loophole around these. Like, it's going to be an arms race against people that are trying to call out and keep AI art in check and other people that just want AI art because it's cheap. Or maybe AI generators are going to go behind a paywall someday, and that's going to slow people's roll on this because it will no longer be free. So there's a lot of different ways I could see about going. Right now, it seems like people are not making money on AI art generators other than maybe like advertising and things like that. But if you put a paywall up, you could generate a lot more money.
Which is true.
It's going to be interesting. It's so new right now. It's just taking off and nobody kind of knows what to do with it right now. But somebody's going to harness it one way or the other to make a lot of money off of it or to save a lot of money off of it. And that's going to be a bummer. It's going to be a bummer.
Well, that just about wraps up our conversation today. Thank you so much for coming on to this show today and giving us insight into how to communicate science effectively and the issues in it. So this was Callie Moore, Collections Manager from the University of Montana Paleontology Center and co-host of Eons. So if any of you listeners would like to learn more about her work, you can find her PBS show Eons at youtube.com/Eons or her Instagram fossil_librarian. And that about does it for the show tonight. So hopefully you all are leaving with a little more knowledge about what it takes to communicate science effectively. And tune into next week's show on the 11th with Ben Donahue. Have a good evening, everyone.
The Salon Piano Series presents Bill Charlap and Rini Rosnes on Saturday, April 6th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, April 7th at 2 p.m. at Farley's House of Pianos. Bill Charlap and Rini Rosnes, two of the premier pianists in jazz who are also husband and wife, have joined forces to record their first collaborative album, Double Portrait on Blue Note. Their live shows feature lively renditions of exquisite four-hand jazz piano duets. More information can be found at salonpianoseries.org. The Salon Piano Series presents Bill Charlap and Rini Rosnes on Saturday, April 6th and Sunday, April 7th at Farley's House of Pianos, 6522 Seabold Road in Madison. Live music lives at WORT Madison. Thank you.
Welcome to Radio Literature, Madison's weekly look at poetry, fiction, nonfiction, theater, and experimental writing for readers of all ages. Settle in for a half hour of conversation on radio literature. Here's your host, Melvin Hinton.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Radio Literature. Tonight, our guest is the director of a film that's participating right now in the Wisconsin Film Festival. He's Michael Nielsen, and he's director and maybe producer as well. I'll ask him in a minute, of String Theory, which will be showing this Sunday, I believe, and I'll verify that with him also at Music Hall on campus. So, Michael Nielsen, welcome to Radio Literature.
Thank you so much for having me, Melvin. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here because, as I mentioned to you in an email, Richard Davis is one of the first people I met outside my immediate department because I came in as a graduate student. And unfortunately, the person who took me there and introduced me later went to prison, which is an unfortunate thing. I hate to have that connection, but I met Richard Davis and I saw him several times after that. But before we go into String Theory, I was amused by a phrase that I saw in the note I have on